said you can kill my body, but you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with Matt Morrison. He's the executive director of Working America, which is the community organizing branch of the AFL-CIO. We're here talking just following the presidential election, and there are many different interpretations, but this is all, what you might say, based in the context of the COVID experience and all kinds of other economic turmoil that has surrounded it. Matt is an expert in diagnosis and analysis, what we might call the mathematical realities that underpin electoral behavior and strategy. Matt, thank you for joining me here today.
Rob, great to be with you today. Thanks for taking the time.
You are a friend of my dear friend, Ira Arlook, and I've been hearing your name for a long time, and it's nice to finally be able to sit down with you and explore. We start our conversation here just before Thanksgiving in 2020 and the, an ominous new phase in the COVID crisis appears to be before us. We're amidst the transition to a new president. And I'm just curious, what are you seeing that makes you hopeful? What are you seeing that gives you heartburn? What are you not seeing that you wish you were seeing?
Well, that's a great place to start the conversation. As I look at what the results of the election tell us, and really what it tells us about the state of America, not just what it tells us about the state of politics, my ongoing optimism, and I like to say I'm perhaps the most optimistic person I know, has been unfazed. The opportunity for us to form a different trajectory in our society is still present and before us. It's just urgent because this is now a life and death matter for millions of people. So what do we see that makes me optimistic, and what do we see that's a cause of concern? In terms of what makes us optimistic, clearly having a transition in the White House takes a lot of the immediate pressure off of us to make sure that we don't have a cataclysmic outcome or that we don't have leadership that is driving us towards a cataclysmic outcome is probably a better way to put that. So it gives us a little bit of breathing space. And we also see the raw material of a more institutionalized and empowered working class able to have agency in its own economic destiny is still before us. What worries me, of course, is we're at 260,000 infections a day at this point and climbing. We know that people are making plans to gather for the holidays. And as one social media meme is going around saying, you can have a big Thanksgiving and a big Thanksgiving dinner equals a small Christmas funeral. We have to be sober-minded about how much longer it's going to take us to get past this peak. But I see it in our own work that the power to change the trajectory even of this infection is within our hands. Convincing individuals to mask would dramatically reduce the viral spread. That's no surprise. But getting people to that place where they recognize that it's in their own self-interest to do so, and that it doesn't make them a weaker person, it doesn't infringe upon their liberties, there's a lot of indications that you can convince people of that very fact if you endeavor to do so. So that's a broad stroke of what I see right, what concerns me, and where I see the potential.
There recently, I read a book that seemed kind of, aligned with the kind of work you do. It was a diagnosis that was published by the Brookings Institution from two authors, Stephanie it's Muravchik and John Shields, called Trump's Democrats. And it was trying to understand what happened that produced 2016, and then with a lot of what I'll call field research, including interviews, kind of a multidisciplinary approach, what created a resilience. And one of the things, despite that Biden has won, that I've heard a number of people comment on, is in light of the poor handling of the COVID crisis, in light of the very, very extreme behavior as a world leader of our then President Donald Trump, the election was way too close. And so they were writing before the election, but it was sort of like, what's changed? What decomposition and what healing do we have to do within the Democratic coalition, where it appeared something like the New Deal coalition broke down and the working class people were somewhat disillusioned with what Michael Sandel calls the tyranny of merit. He's a Harvard political philosopher who's recently released a book and made a podcast with me. But I'm curious as to what you saw, what you might call as ex post diagnosis of 2016, what you saw shifting as we moved into this election, and therefore what you would prescribe for the what you might call remedy, where we don't have to go back to such a turbulent and divisive chapter in our politics.
Sure. So I'm a big fan of looking past short-term polling or reporting indicators and looking at more fundamental trend lines, because that trend line always bears out, even if the headline does not. And so if we look at the trend lines, there are a couple of pretty substantial inputs that seem to have contributed mightily to the outcomes in 2016 and are still present in today's electoral outcomes. The first is redistricting and gerrymandering. And while this is, it can feel a little arcane for folks, what you have to appreciate is that the extent to which most states that we consider competitive have been gerrymandered means that there is a massive disinvestment in direct engagement in large swaths of the country because they're no longer politically competitive. And so if there's not a robust two-party competition for a seat in the state legislature, a seat in Congress in Zanesville, Ohio, then Zanesville residents don't get communication. The exact same trend holds up in Cuyahoga County, where there's not the type of robust competition. So it's only the episodic, can I get you to turn out to vote type of interactions that people come to experience as their connection to politics. And it's consistent with a broader trend of contracting local media sources, contracting local newspapers. That is, people are not moored to a political identity writ large. And that is one of the elements that seems to have served Donald Trump particularly well. The second are instrumental variables. The biggest part of politics, as I've been able to observe it, is just showing up. If you look at places that go from getting relatively modest investment or modest political attention to getting robust degrees of political attention, you see these huge categorical changes that happen in very short periods of time. So if you look at Fulton County, Georgia, for example, Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton did roughly the same share of the overall vote. However, voter turnout in Fulton County went up about 120,000 votes from 2016 to 2020. And that margin ultimately helped propel Biden to victory in what's a lopsided Democratic bastion. That's because for the first time in recent political history, Georgia was treated like a battleground state. People were engaged. There was a mechanism by which people would mobilize. The same thing happened in Ohio between, say, 2000 and 2004. So we see this pattern again and again where presence makes a big impact. We also see it going the other direction. Witness how much better Trump did. I'm always a little bit skeptical of exit polls until you can get the voter file data underneath to really understand who's voted and who hasn't. But if you look at the county level trends, that confirms what the exit polls have told us. In a lot of heavily Hispanic, heavily African-American communities, Trump improved his vote share in places where, and that's not just amongst, say, black men, which are, I think, often discussed, but you look even within black women, you look at Latino men, across the board, Trump did better. Where Biden seemed to overcome that was with a huge surge in college-educated voters, a huge surge in the suburbs and exurbs. And so the politically attuned and attentive are trending towards Joe Biden. The politically overlooked and ignored, when Trump shows up, are tending towards him. And so taking a real hard look at those inputs gives us a sense then of where can we go from here forward. The first thing that I think the Democratic coalition needs to give attention to is continuing to be in touch with its own vote. So you can't assume that demography is going to be destiny and that black voters or Latino voters will be the salvation of the Democratic coalition. You actually have to engage that population in the same way that you would engage a white working class population that is tended over a longer period of time more rightward. And as people have more information, they wind up tending to be more progressive in their politics. The second thing is we need to create institutionalized influences or institutionalized actors that can help facilitate the delivery of economic change. And what I mean by that is it is very difficult for us as individuals to collectivize our action. It is much easier for an institutionalized actor to make a decision and implement. And so the vast working classes need some type of institutionalized input to drive outcomes. Having control of government is a pretty good start. Having the ability to inform how the retail and consumer-facing markets behave, that would help, but that's hard to institutionalize. How do you really start to form the type of institutional structures that can be a counterweight to the forces disrupting people's lives? That's the medicine, if you will, to what has otherwise been this rightward shift of the disengaged and underinformed.
You see, as some in the world of international economics talk about, a change. What, for instance, Raghu Rajan, the former governor of the Reserve Bank of India, he's a professor at Chicago, has written a book called The Three Pillars about markets, national governments, and the need for more local sensitivity. The idea that the domain of the sovereign is much smaller than the scope of the market. So some people become despondent because they know the people that represent them can't control all of the things that, which you might call, produce an outcome in their life. And so they kind of throw up their hands, or they become what is now referred to as nationalists, where, which you might call disentangling from the international, global trade and so forth, becomes a source of advocacy, or much more aggressive anti-immigration policies. And how would I say, I'm not speaking as an orthodox economist where I think these criticisms have no basis. I think there's been a tremendous amount of dislodging, disruption, and suffering. But I didn't know if there was a pattern that you discerned in your trend analysis that impinges upon the political coalitions?
Yeah, so the pattern, there's a great bit of research by a couple of SUNY Stony Brook professors, Krupnikov and Ryan. They published in the New York Times not long ago indicating that there's roughly 80% of Americans who don't see a role for politics in their everyday life. And so when we really imagine who is the politicized class, the MSNBC and Fox News watchers, versus who are the rest of the voters, we really do have different conceptions of what we're fighting for and what the role of government is. There is a broad narrative that government does not work, and it's, you know, there's a it's not strictly partisan, but there is certainly a conservative consistency that when the reins of government are taken by conservatives, there's a lot of effort made to make sure government doesn't function, and it furthers the perception that government and the sovereign itself is limited in its ability to impact outcomes in the lives, and therefore it doesn't matter. That combined with the lack of meaningful attachment to a source of political and economic knowledge and a source of agency are all present factors in where we find ourselves in terms of the masses and the orientation towards the structure of markets, the national sovereign, and the need for more localized sensitivities. I would contend that we need look no further than how intense the fight for control of the national sovereign is to see that the scope and power of that sovereign is far more vast than most people would realize. One thing that Trump and Trumpism showed us really clearly is that a president with a bold agenda, or who is willing to take bold action and has a compliant legislative branch, can do a lot of harm to a different interest, and it can do a lot of good. And so I am not a subscriber to the notion that the sovereign's ability to affect life outcomes is more constrained than the need of its constituency. That said, markets are markets. Markets have an enormous influence, and the markets are going to continue to be influenced by those who have aggregated capital at a disproportionate level. But so is government. And so the ability to move in a direction of convergence in terms of the distribution of wealth and opportunity is really a function of playing on all fronts. That is, we need a effort that focuses on using the levers of government and sovereignty to actually set the rules of set the terms of the economy, set the rules of global trade, set the rules of intellectual property, set the rules of digital privacy, set the rules of health insurance and health care access conditions. So the sovereign has the ability to set the rules in ways that are more meaningful to the lives of daily people. It is not sufficient by any means. And so the missing piece is then, where's the market-based capability? I come from the labor movement, and so the way the labor movement has traditionally affected the market inputs and influences is through collective bargaining, through unions. But that is not the only way that one can affect markets. You see it in, you know, fits and starts, I'd say, in the burgeoning ESG space, where asset holders are becoming more active managers. or active with the managers of their assets. It's not sufficient. It's not as broad-based as it can and should be, but clearly it illustrates the potential for diversifying the tools of that vast working class, that 80%, to actually impact that market variable. In terms of the element, and I don't mean to adhere too closely to this framework of markets and national sovereign and local sensitivity, but there's some real usefulness to that. People trust what's closest and proximate in their lives. And so there's more trust in local government than there is in state government than there is in the federal government. There's more trust in local institutions than national institutions, than global institutions. The closer to someone's day-to-day life, the more they can tangibly observe and be a part of it, the more they see control and respect for their own well-being. If we are to actually solve this question of how to ensure a reflective market, a reflective sovereign, then part of what we have to do is help people get greater transparency, visibility into what is the purview, what is within the purview of a local institution, intermediate institutional, a national or a global institution. And by more clearly understanding that, then we can all make collective choices that change the incentives. I'm a big fan of looking at how fund managers vote proxies, and by and large, it's overwhelmingly as the board directors would otherwise recommend, even when that's inconsistent with the broader economic interest of those 401k holders. If those 401k holders have a clearer understanding that, wait, this is my proxy that you're voting, and are able to communicate that, then at a bare minimum, there becomes a greater critical review and independent review of these proxy votes by fund managers. And that's what I mean by really illuminating the systems by which individuals can influence the institutions that are part of their lives.
Yeah, it seems like what you might call the currency of votes needs to be rebalanced relative to the currency called dollars in the design, implementation, and enforcement of social rules. And we've certainly I do work all over the world. I think we struggle with that as much or more than any other nation at this juncture of the advanced countries. But I think the other concern that I have, and I have to say, the first person I heard about it from was a man named Douglas Frazier at the United Auto Workers when I was his paper boy in Detroit, which is, if the world is going to move to being global, the floor on labor conditions and the floor on environmental conditions increasingly has to be set so that we're not allowing capital to chase to the place where humans can be exploited and the environment can be destroyed. And my sense, you're much closer to the labor movement than I am, though I do sit on the board of EPI, Economic Policy Institute. My sense is that the various free trade agreements and things that we've had have been quite, what you might call, disheartening, even during the Obama years, because they seem to be the province of corporations to negotiate, but weren't really subjected to a democratic, transparent process. And it was often done in the name of U.S.-China national security rivalry. But my friends growing up in Detroit, both those who have advanced degrees and those who work with their hands, were extremely, extremely suspicious of what you might call the intent of globalization, which tended to strengthen the power of lightning-fast financial capital and technology relative to the power of people and labor.
It sounds like your friends are right on the money. You know, I'm a big fan of, I've got an uncle. He's been an airline mechanic for about 30 years. And you want to understand anything about how the commercial aviation sector in this country works, ask an airline mechanic. You know, that is, people know how they eat. And it's not just about my uncle. It's about all of my uncles and all of the people who are similarly situated around the world. They understand maybe not the fine details of high finance or technology or even trade deals, but they understand the outcomes and who's at the table and who's not. So it's not surprising to me to hear that analysis. I think that what you've put your finger on in terms of a global economic floor, I quite frankly, I'm curious how we achieve that. I don't have, to be clear, I don't have brilliant ideas on that one.
It's hard because it's beyond the domain of any sovereign or national. On the other hand, when we, what you might call, send our national leaders into battle, or into co-design rather than battle, I don't want to quite be so military in analogy, we need cooperative solutions that are representative. Where I'm really riffing on here is, you discussed the nature of trust in and proximity. Well, now people with the internet, with all kinds of television and being able to see videos around the world, are familiar with global issues. I remember William Grider's book, which I talked with him a lot about as he was making, One World, Ready or Not, was the title. And the sense of, I trust my local politician, maybe the state level, national and global, well, they're getting further and further away. So the what you might call the natural distrust probably grows. But when you see these processes and not at all reflecting the local needs, I think it accelerates that despondency. And I guess I would conjecture that that was some of what gave Donald Trump a lot of running room in 2015 and 16, when he started, how would you say, it's almost like his bumper sticker was, the system is rigged. A whole lot of people nodded yes when he made that utterance. And a whole lot of people in positions of elite power, the highly educated at elite institutions and so forth, what David Halberstam almost facetiously called the best and the brightest, didn't seem to, by the way, that book was written about the failures of Vietnam. But they just didn't act like they could see these concerns. And yet we were supposed to trust in this meritocracy where they were the people sent to do the best for the country. I remember meeting with Chinese officials. I've been going to China frequently since 1990 when I worked in the investment business. And Chinese officials said, look, Donald Trump's trying to get everybody mad at China. China's a big country. When we started this process, our average living standard was 1/40th of that in the United States. And yeah, you're the tugboat, Europe and United States, but we're an awful big barge to be hauling. We almost sunk the tugboats. But what they said in China is, there's one thing we don't have power over, which is the trade adjustment assistance, the transformation support, the re-education that the transformation, which makes free trade that thing that can make everybody better off and nobody worse off, a reality. And we don't see in America, given the role of money in politics, that we're doing anything other than watching people make a lot of money and then cut their own lobby to cut their own taxes and keep their money offshore. I think we need a much more holistic design to be able to stay engaged with the global economy and to rebuild some of that trust that's atrophied that you were alluding to.
You know, there's a lot there. Go ahead.
But I don't have a design which I can see more the illness than I can see the prescription for healing.
Sure. And to be clear, I was not saying that I don't see the tools by which one can create global floors. I mean, we see all the time that market access is the coin of the realm when it comes to how global leaders make policy choices and build domestic alliances. And so the U.S. still has a remarkable concentration of control over market access in ways that when it decides to do so, it can change global behaviors. So there's no question about that. The power itself currently exists. Where I think there is a question is how does one overcome the interest that preclude that from happening, not just in the U.S., but preclude that from happening in China, preclude that from happening in Europe, preclude that from happening in Brazil, that preclude it from happening in all of these places where capital is flowing to in seek of return. And so if we are being clear, it is a massive series of localized political fights that are hard to cohere into a singular direction, the same way that capital can very readily speak in a single voice. So I think I perhaps have a different perspective than you do on this particular point. I would say that going a step further, though, the need for closing the awareness gap is so spot on. The more a kind of pluralized population is aware and information feels proximate of the global systems around us, then the more likely they are to be able to interact with, understand, and try to influence those things. It's, you know, and so that proximity variable is really about proximity to your life, proximity to your comprehension, not just physical geographic proximity to where you are. And so there is potential there. Trump understood better than most in his 2016 cycle that, one, you have massive disinvestment from the type of political organizing, you have declining unionization, you have that was a anchor for lots of small town Midwestern communities to get and have a proximate and trusted source of information about the political economy. It was a bit of a perfect storm. He exploited that. And he certainly animated people with racist rhetoric. There's no doubt about that. But he really exploited these kind of instrumental vulnerabilities. You fast forward to today, and he put $500 million before this calendar year into list building. He understands far better than Democrats do the importance of having these channels of engagement that are proprietary almost, that in a way that allows him to fill that vacuum. And so we should take a lesson from this, that there's a competition for the currency of the voter, to paraphrase your term, that when given appropriate attention, it is something that can pay you enormous dividends. So it's no wonder that Trump, because he has invested so much in that currency building and that engagement mechanism, got the but for Joe Biden's vote total, he got more votes than anyone else who ever has gotten who's run for president in the United States in a losing effort. So let's keep that perspective in mind. Having the mechanisms, the channels by which to localize your and connect your relationship and build something that's close to responsive to how the working class masses see themselves is a critical dimension to how we understand flattening the decision structure, as you said, and make ourselves ready for the one world.
Let me ask you to put on a bit of a policy hat here for a minute. Mm-hmm. Given what you know about the trends, the data, the rise of Trump, and the demise of Trump, Joe Biden calls you into the office on the 22nd of January, 2021, and he says, "What do I need to do in the next 100 days so that we never go back to that place? What policies, what things for the common good, what irreversible changes, given your study of the electorate, would convince them that we're not back on the right course, but now on the right course and don't need to return to the kind of response to despair that Donald Trump embodied?"
Sure. So I think you said something that I want to distinguish and then speak to the question. It's less about convincing people and more about showing them. Don't tell me what you want me to believe, but show me that it's believable and I'll believe it. And so what are the aspects of social change that would dramatically improve the life outcomes of people who have been receptive to despair messages? I think you have to get down to the bottom line. This is wages. There is not a mechanism currently that moves people up the wage scale. So if you look, and it creates greater wage security. Collective bargaining is limited in its impact right now because the laws have been so neutered and the global economy has been so averse to the interest of collective bargaining, at least domestically. That's been the case. So it dramatically enhancing the role of collective bargaining would be job one. Two, I think he has to visit the decision structures in the financial system that incentivize wealth, essentially keeping money on the sidelines. If capital is more aggressively forced to seek returns, then there's going to be more capital flow, and there's going to be more opportunity for folks to earn a chance to attract that capital flow and innovate, improve their improve our economies. Three, every tax shelter that can be cracked down on administratively should be, and these are all actions that he can leverage from his perch in the Oval Office without congressional intervention. It would certainly be a lot easier if he did have congressional support. But these are all things that are within the executive branch's authority. You start to really turn the knobs on how capital is hoarded and how it's distributed. Then suddenly the incentive structure for the economy that reaches Toledo, Ohio has changed. The economy that reaches Lumberton County, North Carolina has changed. You are no longer dealing with populations without access to capital. Capital is coming knocking because it's looking for returns other than fast food joints and privately operated prisons.
The I guess the sense of I'm putting up a straw man, but there are a lot of people who say the Democratic Party has become an educated self congratulatory elite which calls itself a meritocracy, and that the abandonment by the Democratic Party of what you might call the working class of, how would I say, the FDR to Lyndon Johnson coalition, and substituted the magnetic field of identity politics in to fill the breadth of the coalition. Well, you're a very well-educated man. You're a black man, and you're working with the working class. I see you having, like, sensitivity to all of these dimensions. And I don't know whether the allegation of the breakdown in the progressive coalition is as it's described, or whether that's what you might call a Fox News divisiveness that's thrown in to widen that divide or arouse further suspicion and breakdown. But I guess what Mark Little wrote was he felt the progressive need to recapture a sense of we, and that the we has broken down between that educated elite and the white working class. Do you think that's a valid perspective, or how do you put all of these cross currents into a cohesive place for the future?
Yeah. If you don't have bread, you pray. Meaning, if you are concerned about scarcity, then you are given to emotional comfort elsewhere, whether it's prayer or nationalism I don't mean to equate those two things, but that is just the trajectory of human history. And so the way I would attempt to square those observations are that, one, there's been a rise in the Democratic political class, which is not the same as the Democratic coalition, of leaning more heavily on identity politics that don't challenge the economic distribution of opportunity or wealth, because there's been a convergence of well-heeled interest into the alignment with, these college-educated suburbanites and urban population centers. But it has done little to address the underlying economic insecurity long-term. I mean, it's not news to anyone, and I think EPI is actually the source of the well-known graph that shows that a divergence between wages and productivity from 73 forward. And it's not news to anyone that
I've opened dinette conferences with that graph behind my back. that's very profound.
I live by that graph. I think that it explains so much of where we find ourselves presently. And so it's not to say that, oh, those poor white working class rural voters, how great they despair, and therefore they were reactionary. Instead, one needs to take a more nuanced view. You have some depressed participation in our political economy there. You still have, a relatively new F-150 driving $75,000 a year earner in Lima, Ohio, who is making up the bulk of Trump's vote. So there's this relationship in as much as approximate to each other, but it doesn't mean that the below $50,000 voter is swinging towards Trump. It means that there's a greater share of those voters, and therefore their lack of participation and lack of clear sorting partisan choices shows up as a correlate with a more robust and identity polarized F-150 driver. So those things kind of exist in tandem and are often conflated. When we look at the choices that the Democratic political establishment has to make, there is a question of, are we intending to engage this broad working class, and in so doing, to confront the equilibrium that we currently have with the well-heeled interest of the party. There's nothing that is predetermined that shifting opportunity and resource allocation so that it is more broadly enjoyed actually is going to reduce profits from the C-suite. In fact, we may well do better by having a healthier consumer class, but we have to make choices. And right now, we are not making those choices. We're making choices to encourage the consolidation of capital to the detriment of that bottom part of the EPI graph, and creating ever increasing insecurity. You know, about 3 years ago, there was a Princeton study showing that over 90% of new job creation in the last decade was in contingent work, where you don't have stable earnings, you don't have benefits, you don't have those income attributes that lead to economic stability, the like of which I personally have been a beneficiary of. I explained to you earlier that, you know, I come from a couple of generations of Black working class, middle class folks that meant that I would have opportunity to expand and grow my own future. Those opportunities, those types of employment bases, those types of economic bases for families are disappearing rapidly. And at the same time, we have giant tech firms able to spend $200 million to repeal even the most modest of worker protections in California. Because creating that type of stability is inconsistent with their revenue models. And so we have to make different choices if we want to see different outcomes. None of this is preordained.
One of the things that you said in this podcast and kind of set off a light in my head was that relationship between trust and proximity, which I've referred to a little bit earlier, but I want to come back to again. If the globalization is distant and frightening, then if you want to, inspire a coalition at the level of national politics, would the progressive coalition benefit from investing more in the support of state, local, and municipal elected officials? It appears to me that the groups like ALEC and the Republican Party and so forth have done a tremendous amount of work at the state and local level. And that might create what you might call outposts where even if you found what Donald Trump does distasteful, there's a local guy that'll, what you might call, calm your nerves. Or when whoever the national representative is that's on your team, he'll call you and say, hey, look what our guy's doing. In other words, I'm talking about building a vertical chain of trust through investing more at the local level it appeared to me during the Obama years that the Republicans made great strides in that direction, and the Democratic Party has not followed.
Republicans in industry have long had a close relationship, and so it's no surprise that Republicans would advance further in this direction than Democrats have. Although it's also notable that Republicans tend to have a more homogenous constituency in terms of race, age, economic status. So it's easier to cohere that constituency. But put that aside for just a moment. The power analysis that you're talking about, a great example of it is Maricopa County, Arizona. So Maricopa County makes up around 63% of the statewide vote. Obviously, Arizona is ground zero for national politics in terms of presidential outcomes. The House delegation is remarkably competitive because they have a fair maps process. And control of the U.S. Senate is informed by what happens in Arizona. So there's a lot of leverage there. But there's also five Maricopa County commissioners, and each one of them has a single member district. Those Maricopa County commissioners are therefore part of a pipeline, this kind of vertical funnel, where they are more trusted but less powerful, quite frankly, than someone sitting at the national government that has more money and more regulatory capacity to shape the lives of people. That said, the investment, I think, in the Maricopa County Commissioner, as important as that is second to the investment in that Maricopa County Commission district's constituency. If you invest in the actual people at that level and in the institutionalizing of their capacity and understanding of the commission level, of the state legislative level, of the congressional, of the U.S. House level, of the U.S. Senate level, of their importance in national politics, then you can create leverage that closes that gap. You know, a really interesting example of this is the Iowa caucuses, which I won't get into, but there's a lot to say about that. But every 4 years, we go through this. It's almost a ritual where folks start talking about ethanol policy and promoting these national policies that seem to favor a very small corner of the state of Iowa disproportionately and are out of line with or out of step with what, you know, the 8.5 million people who live in New York City or the 7 million Angelenos need, want in their lives. And so there are these places where you can have an outsized strategic leverage that closes that trust gap by making investments in people and their understanding of the systems around them and their ability to influence them.
So as we turn towards January, I guess I'm listening to Ray Charles, and the song in my mind is called Georgia on My Mind.
Yeah.
I know you spent a significant proportion of your life based in Atlanta, and I'm curious, given your analysis, given your work, and given that the Senate's leadership hangs in the balance, what you envision. I've recently watched Robert Greenwald's movie, Suppression 2020, which examined the influence of voter suppression and other treachery on the candidacy of Stacey Abrams in Georgia. But I'm curious what your thoughts are and what kind of call to action you would like to impart to our listeners today.
So Georgia is a really compelling state to be so relevant at this particular moment in time, because it has all of the opportunity and potential in the world if we'll just take it. And what I mean by that is there's, I think, a pretty clear consensus that the respective parties are going to play towards their bases. So all of the Democratic energy is geared squarely at turning out Black voters in the Atlanta metro and further south in the Black Belt, Macon, Columbus, Augusta, and even points further south like Savannah, Albany, Valdosta, where you have substantial Black voter populations, even in some of these rural counties. And the Republican mobilization strategy is, how do you get that Trump voter to come back out again? And what's, you know, the President Trump has got to come to the party, and he is impossible to predict. I'll say that. I think way we really shoot the gap here is by really exploiting the seams. If you look at David Perdue, he got more or less the exact same vote total, exact same voters as Donald Trump. So it was a straight party line vote. People were not showing up to vote for Perdue. They were showing up to vote for Trump, and he was the guy. Kelly Loeffler, the other Republican, obviously did much worse. She was in a bit of a jungle primary where Congressman Collins was also drawing a substantial portion of GOP vote. But that race overall still got fewer total ballots cast in it. As you look at the current polling, Loeffler appears to be in less good position than Perdue, both because she still needs to consolidate that Republican vote, and Warnock, her opponent and the pastor, Ebenezer, is popular. He is, people recognize him, African-American voters recognize him, Metro Atlanta voters recognize him, and so he's done a faster job of that consolidation. What that tells me is that there's a whole bunch of folks who are, and I should also say, in the Perdue Ossoff race, there's about 100,000 voters who cast third-party ballots. So what that tells me is that there's a whole bunch of opportunity to, one, affect who shows up and the relative motivations for the Perdue Loeffler voters to show up is really just tied to Trump. And so if he's not playing, then do they show up? Obviously, the Black voter turnout efforts are going to get substantial engagement and investment, as they should. But thirdly, there's an opportunity to take people who are weakly aligned partisans, largely in the Atlanta metro and some of the less populous small counties, and give them a reason to sort between a bunch of candidates that they don't know or feel strong attachment to. So I think the opportunity for us in Georgia, if we follow the type of playbook that, you know, Stacey Abrams actually ran a broad coalition playbook in her 2018 campaign. It was not simply a matter of turning out Black voters. She wanted to reach into persuasion territory as well. We run that coalition, we run it effectively, and we take advantage of a demobilized Trump vote, then where Georgia winds up, not just this year, or not just in 2021 in terms of shaping the trajectory of the Senate, but also it changes what we see as viable longer term for our national politics. Georgia becomes one of the most competitive gubernatorial states in the country. The politics, similar to the Maricopa County example I just illustrated of the Metro Atlanta region, changes how we view our own national politics. So the ability to influence that that Metro Atlanta politic body politics matters even more to our national landscape. So all to say, we've got great opportunity if we'll take it. There are some unknowns, namely Trump. And bullish may be a bit of an overstatement, but I think that the fundamentals favor us in these runoffs if Trump will do what Trump does, which is only work in his own best interest.
Well, Matt, you said at the outset that you were perhaps the most optimistic person. And I think that the vitality that you bring to bear in your career and to this podcast and something is something we should all be grateful for. I think I mentioned to you in preparation that my three sisters-in-law and my mother-in-law live in Atlanta as well, and they're very energized by this. They live near a place called Stone Mountain, which has a rather uncomfortable history. Mm-hmm. But I was reminded as I was thinking about the enthusiasm that I've uncovered for the path that you're on. And there's an old song by Jackie DeShannon called What the World Needs Now is Love. And the second verse says, Lord, we don't need another mountain. There are mountains and hillsides enough to climb. There are oceans and rivers enough to cross, enough to last till the end of time. What the world needs now is love, sweet love. Well, I'm thinking more like the kind of love of an embodiment of spirit rather than romantic love, as they often sing about in songs. But you've gone from this place of cultivating an education, as a black man becoming a leader, gone to law school, applied this in the context of working with the AFL-CIO, working in community organizing and working in politics. And to me, that example, that ability to use intellect and heart, bring them together, I think your example is the kind of love that the world needs now. I want to thank you for being with me here today, and I hope you'll come back again and again from time to time and share with our listeners the way you see things unfolding and giving us guidance on where you'd like us to go. But for now, thank you for today. This was a delightful conversation.
Rob, thank you. This has really been a thought-provoking discussion, and I'm appreciative of the work that you do for advancing these conversations and what the Institute for New Economic Thinking does to change the paradigm on how we approach our global political economy. So thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you. We'll talk again soon.
Okay, we'll talk soon.
Bye-bye. Bye. And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it, and reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking, but I'll know my song well before I start singing.